All right, thank you very much. Today I'd like to talk to you about some work that I've been doing in collaboration with several people, Carl Stiefel on the modeling, and a larger group that's been working on these Hanford sediments that we have weathered under hyperalkaline conditions. And then what we've been doing is trying to understand the desorption or release of cesium, strontium, and iodide in after we expose these sediments to a background pore water solution. And I just want to mention there's a lot of collaborators on this project. Some of their data is here. Also, Hun Sheik is going to present some data that's very similar to this in the next talk, so you have a good half hour of this sort of broader project to digest. So just briefly, many of you probably know this, and so I won't spend a lot of time, but the project that we're working on and the idea here is that when there was a lot of plutonium production, this created a lot of highly alkaline waste that was contaminated with several radionuclides. Some of this waste leaked into the sediments, and that caused weathering of those sediments and then subsequent formation of neophases. And so we haven't taken these particular sediments. We've taken pristine Hanford sediments, and we've repeated this in the laboratory to examine these processes. And in principle, what we have done is take a look at a 2x2x2 experimental matrix. So we have weathered large quantities of these sediments, so we can do a lot of different types of experiments with them. And in a low contaminant concentration field, a high contaminant concentration, and then also where we excluded CO2 for the weathering of these materials, and then we allowed CO2, atmospheric CO2, we essentially bubbled CO2 in for the whole reaction period of time. And we weathered these for 6 months and 12 months. A lot of this work was done previously in small scale conditions, so we use that as our model to understand how long we had to react the sediments to get the transformations that we wanted. And just briefly, I'm not going to focus on this, but there are several neoform phases that are formed principally, and there's many other phases that pop out in more minor quantities, but I just want to focus on the major differences between these treatments. And that is, in terms of the calcium chemistry, we do form a fair amount of calcite in the CO2, the plus CO2 treatments. And then in the minus CO2 treatments, there is calcite in these sediments, so that then releases a lot of calcium into the reaction vessel, and then there's precipitation of stratlingite. And then in terms of the neoform phases that may be implicated in trapping or controlling the fate of cesium and strontium, principally what we have seen, there's the mouse, is that under low contaminant concentrations, we form sodalite type felspathoid phases, and under high contaminant concentrations, we form zeolite phases that are very similar to like a chabazite type material. And just to give you some TEM images of this in these four fields. And then also to show you, we have sort of XRD data as well as strontium XS to sort of back this up. This is really sort of, at this point, I think, fairly well established in terms of that we would definitely have these phases formed in the sediments. And now the question is, when we start to weather this material or we start to leach this material with background pore water solution, what happens to the cesium and strontium, and how does that, how do these different conditions affect it? So our initial steps in this were to try to understand the desorption under long-term conditions in the very early stages, which I'm going to focus on for most of the remainder of the talk. There's a lot of transient effects that are very complicated, difficult to model, and actually today I'm hoping to sort of present some data to you and maybe get feedback that might help us sort of move forward in trying to understand the direction to move for these sort of transient phases. In the longer term desorption step, we did some experiments where we made fairly small columns and we used replicated treatments. Collected those in a fraction collector and ran that for 500 to 600 pore volumes. We had our conceptual, the modeling approach that we took to sort of understand this from the ion exchange perspective was one that Carl Stiefel had presented in 2003, which was a generalized planar site and then two frayed edge sites. And then I'll talk to you about how I've modified that to deal with the data. And this just shows you in general what we did is simply take the parameters that Carla derived from sort of a global fit of a lot of experiments that John Zakharov's group had done, but also some column experiments that Carl did as well. And then we added into this some, because there wasn't data for strontium and magnesium, and so we added that in. Basically, it was sort of affinity terms that were based on the hydrated ion radius of those two ions. And so for this longer term stage modeling, what we observed, and I think we were able to show pretty well that cesium was clearly being desorbed from these frayed edge sites, even at 600 pore volumes. We sort of expected that maybe that would have been that cesium released from these frayed edge sites would have been exhausted by that time, but simply taking Carl's model with very minor modifications to the potassium selectivity coefficient, we could show that that wasn't the case. And then for strontium, we had to implicate another mechanism, and desorption from the felspathoids was fit the model data pretty well. Although I'll show in terms of the mechanism that there's still some questions. I think there's, I'll show you some data in a moment to reflect on that. And so what I want to show here is simply one of the terms we examined initially in terms of modeling the cesium release was simply to take the three-site model from Carl Stiefel's 2003 paper, and then change the amount of cesium that was loaded onto the ion exchange sites during the reaction weathering. And then what you can see essentially is that, you know, here is 100% of the cesium that's sorbed to the soil loaded onto the ion exchange sites. That's clearly not what is happening. And here is only 3% of the cesium. That's probably not what's happening either. But when we get into the range of sort of in the 20% of the total cesium sorbed onto those sites, we start to get a pretty good fit for the data. Then subsequently, if we modify the potassium selectivity term, which was poorly constrained in the original experiments, we can get a good fit for the data, at least at sort of a coarse level. Okay, so in the early transient period, there's a lot more complexity going on. There's dissolution of really short-range ordered felspathoid and zeolite phases. And so that's now what we're trying to focus on and understand, because to move to sort of any type of predictive mode, we need to capture this sort of early stage release as well. Okay, so I just want to present some data. Essentially here we took, before we had three replicated treatments, here we have just taken a higher resolution collection and only one replicate per treatment. So a little bit of a trade-off there. And in essence, you see we have a lot more data points to play with than we had before. And I'm going to just show you a couple of sort of coarse level observations, which is that, as you might expect, the release of strontium is very closely tied to the calcium that's coming in from the inlet solution. And in particular, these high contaminant formed sediments release their cesium or their strontium at later pore volumes than the low treatments. And then for cesium, it's broadly tied to the breakthrough curve for potassium. So sort of what you'd expect. It's nice to see it come out this concretely in our curves here. So now what I want to do is focus in on this less than 200 pore volume region. And I want to present a fitting approach, sort of an algorithm that I've taken to try to understand how to approach the fitting of this data and try to extract some information along the way that might be useful, help us understand something, because we're dealing with such a high level of complexity. It's, I think the last speaker and other people have talked about this. You get to this place where you get a lot of parameters and you fit all those parameters, but then you might lose a little bit of information that you could gain from a very sort of simpler model. Okay, so the first step was to simply take the model that we had before and adjust the potassium selectivity on the planar site, which I mentioned before was poorly constrained in the batch experiments. And I'm going to show you several of these figures, and with various, each time I step through a different perturbation of the model. So I'm going to just explain them briefly the first time. So this is sodium. All the data are in micromole per liter, except pH. And this is sodium, calcium, potassium, nitrate, strontium, cesium, pH, iodine, and DIC. And so what we see simply by applying this model without any modification except for this planar potassium affinity constant is that we get a pretty good breakthrough curve for cesium and strontium. It's at a sort of coarse level, it matches quite well for this particular treatment. And we can hit our potassium sort of in the middle of the curve, so we can fit that. That's about, we can't quite capture this sort of drawn out element of the characteristic of the potassium curve. And also we're not matching at all our sort of pH. So this is a good sort of first step. An obvious next thing to do is to impose sort of almost local equilibrium with calcite. And so that is the next thing that was I imposed in the model. And then at the later pore volumes, we get a good fit for calcite. So in other words, there is calcite sort of pseudo-equilibrium or local equilibrium that's probably maintaining the pH at this particular level during these experiments. And we still are far off on a lot of other treatments. And so the next step then is to try to deal with, actually, let me go back.
Use the right mouse button.
Right mouse button.
Oh, I never use the right mouse button. the next step is to sort of begin to include some of these really high levels of sodium that happen in the early stage release, nitrate, and as well the DIC. And this is principally because that's probably going to affect, right, our ion exchange that we're seeing in the rest of the treatment. And so to do that, we dissolve a short-range order feldspathoid, which I've sort of called a bogusoid because it's sort of a conglomeration of whatever we're sort of throwing in there within the constraints of the mineral, because we don't have data that we can look to support the actual composition of this mineral phase. It's there's not enough of it, and it's not crystalline enough to detect. And so we can fit the data with a pretty well for sodium, so that at least we think that we have captured that in terms of the impact on cesium and strontium. Nitrate as well, and pH is a little bit off, but that is going to be difficult given that we're measuring with a pH electrode that is probably not giving us real values up here above 10 anyways. And then you see that we're also matching the DIC quite well. So 3 minutes, John? Okay, somewhere around there. I'm good. Okay. So what the next thing that I considered was that we're not at all capturing this sort of slower release of strontium here in the curve. And this could be due to dissolution of another shorter range ordered feldspathoid. Could also be due to a high selectivity strontium site, either on a planar site or maybe within one of these feldspathoid type phases. And so one of the things that we did to sort of try to figure out if we are actually getting a lot of dissolution of these feldspathoids or if we are getting ion exchange within the cages is to run these experiments out to long pore volumes. So here's we measured nitrate after 8,000 pore volumes, leachings, 3 months essentially for these lab experiments. And then what I've shown here in the stars are the concentration of nitrate relative to feldspathoid. So we get a decrease in the feldspathoid. We also get a decrease in the amount of total amount of nitrogen in the soil. But what we see is that we get a decrease in the concentration of nitrate per gram, if you will, of feldspathoid. So we are losing some nitrate without feldspathoid dissolution. So there's probably two. We have added complexity here. We're probably getting some ion exchange within the cage, but we also are getting dissolution that would release the nitrate and strontium. So we can incorporate that as a high selectivity strontium site in the model. That is shown here. We start to do a little bit better job.
Half a minute.
Okay, I can get there. Thanks. And then the next step is simply to add in these other components and start to parameterize the model. We're now moving farther away to what we're sort of now at the stage where we're trying to just fit the data. And by changing the amount of calcium in that dissolving phase, or potassium in that dissolving phase, we can start to get improvements in the fit for the other ions. And so, in summary, what we see is that transient release involves a coupled ion exchange and short-range ordered mineral dissolution. It suggests that there's potassium and calcium desorption from these sediments, not just coming in from the inlet solution, and that what we're working to deal with is a balance between model complexity and sort of the utility. And the future work is we're focusing on measuring the freatide site density using a variety of techniques, and then also fitting the other treatments. I showed you one. When we have a generalized model that we could then maybe learn something about the differences between those treatments. Okay, thank you very much. Okay.